Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is November 6th, Election Day. Do you know about this? Have you heard about this? I don't really want to talk about that too much. Even though today's show does have a bit of a political theme, as you can tell from the title, we're going to be taking a look at an HBO program called Real Time with Bill Maher, which is a political debate show slash comedy show. Even though the comedy is pretty hack, and the political debate is really hack. But it's useful in our logical fallacy series. We're going to try to focus on just a couple logical fallacies, but oh man, if you listen to this show for more than a minute, you will probably encounter more than just two. And people always say to me, Brett, do you vote? No, I don't. But I feel guilty about that, you know? So whenever this first Tuesday in November comes, I do things that, by the end of the day, I will have felt like I voted. Like already today, I've done a rain dance. And people say, Brett, that's so foolish. It's a beautiful sunny day out in New England. Well, we'll see what happens, won't we? I can hope. I can believe. Later on today, I'll go to an underground auction where people can bid on stolen goods. But I only bid on items that have already been sold. People there look at me like I'm an idiot every year. What is this guy doing? I said, I'm trying to feel like I voted at the end of the day. That's why I do this. On the way home, I live in kind of a bad area. I'll find a group of thugs that are mugging some poor innocent bastard. And, I'll stand there for a few minutes and cheer for them, kind of root them on. And then when they leave the guy bloody and penniless, I'll say, boy, you really should have gotten more involved with that gang. You really should have participated. Even just lending your moral support probably would have prevented this. You have no right to complain, sir. I don't care about Election Day, folks, and I made all that stuff up. I don't do any of that. I'm doing a podcast today, and then I've got to tutor a kid at about 1 o'clock. After that, I'll go to the gym, and after that, maybe I'll go right next door to a little butcher shop called the Meat House and get some pulled pork and visit their salad bar. That's a complete day for me today. Now, yesterday was November 5th, also a day that's kind of a big deal to people on Facebook. Did you enjoy all the Guy Fawkes postings on Facebook yesterday? I certainly didn't. I don't care for Guy Fawkes. Or Facebook, for that matter. And I posted yesterday on the School Sucks page, Facebook is like an obstacle course for one's serenity. I would really like to get off there. In a related story, strangely enough, I'm also looking for more people to like the School Sucks Facebook page, the thing that keeps me on Facebook. Almost 5,000 people like that page. Invite your friends. Like it if you don't like it. It's just putting School Sucks Podcast to the search bar and you'll find it. Also, we have a pretty exciting week. I'm going to have Lorette Lynn on the podcast on Thursday. I'm going to be doing a show called Sex, Lies, and Anarchy podcast on Wednesday. So those are the things that are coming up this week. So anyway, what you're going to hear on the podcast today is the live recording from November 1st, 2001. Very edited version of that show. In fact, I really debated, really just came down to time. I really debated re-recording the whole podcast as a non-live show simply because when you listen to these clips from real time of these political discussion, it just kicks a door open to potential hours of conversation about what goes on this show. Just breaking down all of the faulty premises, the inaccurate background information, exposing the bias of Bill Maher and his guests, where those biases came from, even though it's a little bit hard to tell. But, during the show, somebody put something in the chat that I thought was interesting. And it was a generalization, but provided a little bit of food for thought, at least. So no one in Hollywood has any opinions. They're all just walking billboards. And it really got me thinking about selling out. Did Bill Maher sell out? Is Bill Maher smarter than he lets on, right? Because if you ever listen to his old show, Politically Incorrect, or even if you listen to Real Time during the presidency of George W. Bush, I thought Bill Maher was pretty cool, you know? And it seems like the show, since Obama became president, has become, like I said before, I use the word hack. The comedy on Real Time with Bill Maher is almost effortless. And I don't mean it's just so easy, it requires no effort. It seems like virtually no thought or effort goes into it. He knows he has this choir audience of liberals who came there to laugh, right? When people go someplace to laugh, it's easier to make them laugh. And they're on his side politically. And as a result of that, it seems like he has gotten very, very lazy. But also looking at the trends in the media, even just in the last two decades, generally, this really detectable anti-intellectual direction. If you want an example of this, if you want to prove this to yourself, even though I really don't recommend taking the time to do this, if you saw any of the 2012 presidential debates, just the Republican debates or Romney versus Obamney, go back and watch the 1992 presidential debates between Ross Perot, Bill Clinton, and George H.W. Bush. And it's interesting that I go back to the year 1992, because that was the year that a television program debuted on MTV. And the program that began a very long run, very successful run in 1992, was called The Real World. It was seven people living in a house in New York. They then went on in the next season to Los Angeles, and then to a very explosive season with Puck in San Francisco. Some of you might have no idea what I'm talking about. But this was the first reality TV show. And from there, a virus began to infect the entertainment media. Why a virus? Brett, why do you use the word virus? Well, here's what happened. They would choose people for these shows that if they put them together, entertainment would happen. So they were people who had, you know, they were troubled, they had somewhat explosive tempers, and chaos would ensue and the audience would be entertained. What eventually wound up happening is reality TV went on. And I really think that reality TV is a contributing factor to the acceleration of the dumbing down in American pop culture, at least, as far as what people want from their entertainment. And it doesn't mean there isn't still a lot of like really intellectually engaging, sharp and entertaining programming coming onto television. In fact, I think there's actually, you know, more today because there's more channels, and especially the premium channels moving into doing serial shows in the last decade or so, which is kind of ironic because we're going to talk about a really dumb show on a premium channel most of the show today. But the virus of reality TV is that all of these people who are generally maladjusted or put together, and they fight, and it's fun, and whatever. And then one person stands out as being particularly crazy, and then they get their own show. And the craziest person from that show then gets their own show. And I would say at this point we're like more than 10 generations into that process, where we have one reality TV show, and the shittiest person from that show gets their own show, where they're surrounded with people who they think will be equally shitty, and somebody emerges as the shittiest from that, and then they have their own show. So who's the big reality TV star today? Her name is Honey Boo Boo. She's a little girl. She has spun off from another program called Toddlers and Tiaras. I can't even talk about this anymore, folks. First of all, it's off track. Second of all, if you don't know, Toddlers and Tiaras is about these terrible, terrible people who take their children and turn them into, like, you know, JonBenet Ramsey, six-year-old beauty pageant competitors. We could do a whole series about that show and the filth that it has spawned, i.e. Honey Boo Boo. So is Bill Maher a casualty of this trend in entertainment? Did he have to dumb his show down? Or is this just a natural process, you know, in television? Does his show have to get dumber? Does the humor have to get more lowbrow? You're going to hear a phrase again and again on the show today, low-hanging fruit. It's all they're going after on Real Time with Bill Maher. Was that necessary to make the program more appealing to people who watch, strangely enough, the news, you know, like MSNBC and Fox? But this, is Bill Maher a casualty of trends in entertainment media question? Was this an intelligent mind subsumed by the demands of pop culture question? It was answered for me pretty decisively back in March. And play a clip in a minute. Somewhere in the past, it might have been on Free Talk Live, it might have been on Wheels Off Liberty. Those are places where I think I might have had conversations like this, because God knows I try to stay away from it on this show. I said, in a very derisive way, and there really was probably a much nicer way to say this, and if I could say it again, I would do it differently. But I said, the only thing sillier, this was in 2011, the only thing sillier than being an Obama supporter today, when you look at the parallels between him and George W. Bush, in spite of all that he promised as far as change was concerned, the only thing sillier than being an Obama supporter today would be to be an Obama voter in 2012. Back in March of this year, Bill Maher proved to me that there was something even sillier still.
I would like to tonight announce a donation to the Obama Super PAC, which has the very unfortunate tongue twister name, Priority USA Action. I know, it was named by Borat. But tonight I would like to give that PAC $1 million. This is the wisest investment I think I could make on a selfish level. Because I'll tell you something, folks, who I know look at these Republican clowns and think it's in the bag. No, it's not. Obama could lose.
Well, well said by a smart man as well as a funny man. That's Bill Maher, the host of HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, announcing that he's donated $1 million to President Obama's super PAC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett in the studio with me tonight, Corey and Osborne. Our technical difficulties are sorted out and we're ready to go.
Yes.
That was Poison. No, that was Motley Crue.
I'm enjoying the new music. It doesn't make me fall asleep. It's the old music.
Yeah, we're really going to rock.
We are going to rock.
A lot of 80s stuff. A lot of Zeppelin, a lot of rock. You know, I really want to bury the hatchet with this vendetta that I have against Bill Maher. It's gone on for years.
Is that actually what's going to happen tonight?
Well, I would really like to let go of this resentment that I've been harboring since Obama became president. Now, I was introduced to Bill Maher during the Bush administration. And at the time, I thought Bill Maher was great. I thought he was speaking truth to power.
Oh, yeah.
He was saying some really risky things.
All those lefties were great during that.
Oh, yeah.
And at the beginning of the Bush administration, I was very left-wing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you had Jon Stewart. At the beginning of the Bush administration, Maher did Politically Incorrect, which was a pretty good show. And even Real Time with Bill Maher, which is an HBO show, was very good.
Right. While Bush was in office.
Until Obama became president. And then it turned into like the telescreen from 1984.
Mm-hmm.
It became like total PR for the Obama administration.
Like you would watch it and it would make you do calisthenics.
The sad thing is that when you consider the mainstream media as a whole, Real Time with Bill Maher is pretty much the smartest debate show, political debate show on television.
Sad to say, I think you may be right.
It's true. And what else would even come close? Are there even any other real political debate shows on television? Is the McLaughlin group still on? Could that guy still be alive? Yeah, I don't think that's on anymore. But Maher will bring these other, not just like right-wing people, like people who are walking, living, breathing straw men that he can just, yeah. You know, like they used to do on Hannity and Combs. But they're just coming from this traditional left-right, throw poop at each other, get nowhere kind of paradigm.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Someone in the chat says the McLaughlin group is still on, but it's terrible. Oh. McLaughlin must be very old. He was old in 1982.
He's got to be dead. It must be a different McLaughlin.
Oh, maybe. Maybe his son,
maybe
or his grandson,
like,
or his great-grandson.
McLaughlin is like 007, and he just gets replaced with a new guy periodically.
Yeah, I like that.
Or like he gets really old, and then he dies and regenerates like Doctor Who.
Ah, into a new McLaughlin.
Yeah. Similar but just different enough.
But I think when you are able to do that format on television, outside of the mainstream media, where an honest conversation could take place, that he should see himself as having a responsibility, Mark. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, people can say, oh, Brett, it's supposed to be a comedy show. Now, in our analysis of the Bill Maher show, we're going to exclude two segments. The first thing he does is he comes out and he does like a monologue for 5 minutes, and it's like a stand-up routine. So in a stand-up routine, anything goes, right? But then he does a panel discussion, or he usually does an interview for about 10 minutes where he has some newsmaker on and they talk for 8 to 10 minutes. Then he does this panel discussion for the rest of the show. Mm-hmm. That's the part of the show that I want to analyze. At the end of the show, he does something called New Rules, where he does kind of like another sort of comedy routine.
I do find the New Rules very entertaining.
But it's not something that we could analyze and say, well, you know, I think it's unfair of us,
right,
to criticize him for that, because that is more comedy than the political or, you know, social issues discussion that they're having during the regular show.
Right.
They also do something called Overtime, which is internet only, where they continue the panel discussion for another 10 minutes. So everything that we're going to look at tonight, to be as fair as we can to Real Time with Bill Maher, is going to come from either this political, social panel discussion or the Overtime portion of the show.
Okay.
We are completely excusing ad hominem attacks because it's comedy, right?
Right.
So Bill Maher needs to get a laugh every minute. So he has to, I mean, I'm sure he has like a quota of recycled Sarah Palin MILF jokes that
it's
he has
actually
to do.
Mostly Chris Christie jokes now. Every time I've watched the show in the last couple of years, during the opening monologue, he always makes a fat joke about Chris Christie, which is kind of disappointing to me, frankly, because it's pretty low-hanging fruit as far as comedy goes.
Mm. Yeah, it's a lot of low-hanging fruit. There's not a lot of highbrow humor on it because he has the audience on his side. He's preaching to the choir. You know, and sometimes I watch it, and I don't think my audience is stupid at all. But obviously, if they're listening to me, they like me.
Right.
And sometimes I wonder, like, what can I get away with?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not like I'm trying to get away with things, but I screw up a lot. You know, I talk a lot. So, you know, the more you talk, the more mistakes you make. And when thousands of people hear you, but I don't get much criticism back, but I know I make mistakes.
Right.
So I'm sure a lot of people in our audience are smart enough to catch them and say, "Yeah, Brett, that's not really, yeah, you missed it." But maybe they just don't tell me about
it. It's not that important to them.
I have received a lot of constructive criticism through emails. I've received emails that were very mean, and people were angry, and they
should we do an email segment?
Emails about your German pronunciation. I know.
Yeah, I'd have to dig up the hate mail. But I think that because Maher has the audience so much on his side, he feels like the writers feel like they can get away with a lot more, right? Yeah. They know Sarah Palin joke, Michelle Bachmann joke, Marcus Bachmann joke. These are automatic laughs for the audience. And because of that, I think people would say, oh, you know, it's just comedy, Brett. You shouldn't be trying to critically analyze it, but it's more than that, you know, because he presents himself as a serious social and political commentator. He goes on Larry King. He goes on Piers Morgan.
Right.
He goes on O'Reilly. I mean, that's as serious as it gets in the mainstream media, you know?
Right.
He goes on Chris Matthews. The clip we played at the beginning of the show was from Chris Matthews when he announced that he was giving an Obama super PAC $1 million.
He's a serious political commentator until somebody has something to say against him.
Exactly. And the same thing with Jon Stewart. This is probably even more common with Jon Stewart when he was, you know, he went on Hardball saying, like, the public discourse has to change. Right. So he's standing up as a serious commentator on what's going on in America socially, politically. When they fire back at him, he says, "Oh, I'm just a comedian."
Right.
You know, so they have that place where they can run back to that. This is just entertainment. But the entire mainstream media is just entertainment. Sean Hannity, Chris Matthews, Larry O'Donnell, they're not on television because they're smart. They're on television because they're idiots. And that's entertaining to people.
Right.
People go to the mainstream media for entertainment. Or, you know, this chaotic confusion as entertainment, as news.
Yeah, there's two types of people who would watch something like, you know, like when Rush Limbaugh had a TV show. Like, two types of people watch that sort of thing. People who know he's an idiot and find that entertaining, and people who are bigger idiots than him who think he's smart.
My issue with Bill Maher was, like, what an opportunity exists here to really have some meaningful discussions, because he has Penn Jillette on the show. Sometimes,
right,
you know,
there's
Nick Gillespie on the show. Like, these are people who could, he had Ron Paul. Even when Ron Paul was under fire, we're actually going to use that clip later in the show. When Ron Paul was so under fire after the Republican debate in 2008, years ago, when I continued to watch Real Time, once Obama was president, I formulated this idea, even before School Sucks podcast, I said, somebody should do a podcast called Reality Time for Bill Maher, where they just take the audio of the last show and correct it. If it takes 3 hours, it takes 3 hours, you know?
Hmm.
But this needs to be corrected because there's a lot of people who are taking Bill Maher very serious as a as a social and political commentator. And a lot of corrections need to be made. In fact, it would really be a very, very complex deconstruction because there's so many faulty premises that he's putting fallacies and more fallacies on top of.
I still occasionally do enjoy parts of his show because,
yeah,
you know what I like about it is he'll have people on who are on different sides of the debate between the left and the right. And they each point out things that are wrong with the other side. And I agree with all of them.
That's true. They are good about that. But even in doing that, there's a lot of confusion.
Oh, yes.
You know, and that's something that Maher really makes hay with show after show after show, because there's a lot of things wrong with the right, the political right, the Republicans, the Tea Party, all those groups. So he continually uses that as if there's this false dichotomy of the way I think and the way everybody else thinks. So we're going to discuss primarily two fallacies tonight, and they are called composition and division. I'm going to define them both for you very quickly, and then we're going to actually start getting into some examples from the show. Now, when we use the show, we are going to do more than just composition and division, but that's why I really wanted to try and focus on those two fallacies. But I had to spend like 4 hours yesterday watching Real Time with Bill Maher. And there's a lot, we could have done the whole series using Real Time with Bill Maher. But to focus on composition and division, the composition fallacy results from reasoning from the properties of the parts of the whole to the properties of the whole itself. It is an inductive error. Such an argument might hold that because every individual part of a large tractor is lightweight, the entire machine also must be lightweight. This fallacy is similar to a hasty generalization, but it focuses on parts of a single whole rather than using too few examples to create a categorical generalization. So you take a part of something, you say these are the properties of the part, therefore these are the properties of the whole. And the opposite of the fallacy of composition is the fallacy of division. This fallacy is the reverse of composition. It is the misapplication of deductive reasoning. One fallacy of division argues falsely that what is true for the whole must be true of all the individual parts. Such an argument notes that Microtech is a company with great influence in the California legislature. Egbert Smith works at Microtech. He must have great influence in the California legislature. It is not necessarily true. Egbert might work a graveyard shift as a security guard or as a copy machine repairman at Microtech. Positions requiring little interaction with the California legislature. Another fallacy of division attributes the property of the whole to the individual member of the whole. SunSurf is a company that sells environmentally safe products. Susan Jones is a worker at SunSurf. She must be an environmentally minded individual.
Right. Everyone I worked with when I worked for the phone company was deeply interested in providing phone service. Like, I think everybody I worked with when I was there had grown up going, I want to be the lady at the phone company who answers your call.
Who was the phone company you worked for?
Yeah, it was Vonage, the voice over IP.
Do they still even exist?
Company. Yeah.
Okay, so those are the two fallacies that I want to stick to, composition and division, but we will cover other ones as they come up.
Okay.
Like I said, we're going to excuse ad hominems unless they assist in another type of fallacy, unless an ad hominem is used as a point to insert laughter, where then like a red herring can take place, where the direction of a conversation is turned. But to go back to Bill Maher, I thought we could set the tone. If you're totally unfamiliar with Bill Maher, I think you should have an example of his intellectual integrity. Somebody that most listeners to this show and to LRN.FM would be familiar with is a gentleman named Ron Paul. So he has Ron Paul on during 2008. Ron Paul presents and often identifies himself as a libertarian.
Right.
Bill Maher used to do this before he knew that it was okay to just be a socialist who wants to legalize pot.
Right.
So doesn't call himself a libertarian anymore. But he has Ron Paul on. He doesn't like Ron Paul's economic ideas, obviously. And he is also a Republican candidate for president. So Bill Maher is a little bit on the attack.
Right.
He starts with a fallacy called poisoning the well. poisoning the well is where you kind of like set the other person up to fail.
Right.
By, you know, like it, like saying, oh, Steve, let's hear your stupid idea. Right. The well is poisoned at that point. So the way Marr does it is a little bit more subtle. He says, oh, so Dr. Paul, you are against the Civil War. You don't think we should have fought the Civil War, which to most people who have some kind of mainstream history education, that just seems so ridiculous. Because the Civil War is what set the slaves free.
Right. That was the only reason there was a Civil War, is because slavery.
You would think. These are things that people are told.
Lincoln demanded that we put a stop to that.
He was, yes.
And we'll go to war if we have to, and we did.
So Ron Paul tries to correct some of these, some of this mythology.
Right.
Right. And he says, well, first of all, every other country, you know, every other first world civilized country was able to get rid of slavery without killing 600,000 of their own citizens.
Right.
The cost of the Civil War could have bought all of the slaves. The Union could have taken the money they spent on munitions and just bought all the slaves from the plantations. And Lincoln was no principled anti-slave guy.
Right.
So Paul, he goes on for about a minute, you know, trying to educate Marr a little bit on the realities of the Civil War. He finishes by
saying,
or
at least trying to educate the viewing public.
Yeah, absolutely. So Marr's response to all of this, I mean, just see how interested he is in having a conversation. Marr's response, I think, is very telling.
And if you don't look at that, you're denying a very important part of our history.
All right. Not for the Civil War. What about global warming? Are you on the page that there is such a thing as global warming?
Yeah, I think it's been around for a long time, and it's probably going to be here with us for a while longer. I don't think the ozone has settled on that yet. I don't think everybody knows everything about global warming, because you have reputable scientists on both sides of that argument.
No, you don't.
Well,
no, on the other side, you only have Professor Irwin Corey and the Shell Answer Man. I mean, the reason I'm bringing this up is to say, even as someone who I consider myself somewhat of a libertarian, I think there are some jobs that are so enormous that only the government can do it. And I would put...
That means I have no idea what libertarianism is.
Right, right,
right. I'm a libertarian, but some things I just...
you need the government.
They're so important.
Yeah.
I'm a libertarian except for all the important things.
Right.
Well, that's pretty much the story with...
For example, having a war that kills, that, you know, within the confines of our own country, that kills more than 500,000 people. That's something that everybody should be for.
Yeah. I just opened up Skype, so if anyone wants to join this conversation, if anyone wants to vent, I know that's helpful sometimes. And like I said, one of the goals for tonight's show was to let go of this resentment that I've held towards Bill Maher.
Right.
So... we talked about the well poisoning of, oh, so here's a guy who's against the Civil War. Ha ha ha. And then he asked him about global warming, hoping he can bait him again, right. It seems. And Ron Paul was in the middle of his answer. So I want to just pick that up. We'll finish it. And then we'll get into these two fallacies we discussed, composition and division.
At this point in our very tenuous history, global warming in that list, don't you think the government has to do something about global warming?
Well, then you have to deal with the volcanoes, and you have to deal with the pollution of China. So do you want to invade China to make sure they don't pollute? And what are you going to do about the volcanoes? They are all contributing factors to global warming. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't do what we can to slow up the emissions and stop subsidizing big oil companies. I don't like subsidizing oil companies. They've been doing that for years. We go to war to protect the oil so that we can buy more oil and burn more oil. So I would say our foreign policy contributes to global warming by subsidizing a policy that is deeply flawed, and that's why we're in the Middle East, to protect oil interests. So, yes, that would be one of the first things you should do if you're serious.
But still against the Civil War. Okay. What about the FAA? I mean, that does prevent planes from crashing into each other.
Would pilots be 20,000 feet above our houses playing chicken with each other if it wasn't for bureaucrats?
No.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the air traffic controllers who keep planes from crashing into each other. And I'm sure they would still have those if there wasn't an FAA. Sorry.
Yeah, and every modern aircraft has computers in there that tell them where all the other traffic is at any time anyway.
You know what else they have? Windows.
Right in the front.
in the front
of the pilot.
Best
place for a fast-moving vehicle, I've found from my experience as a driver.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Not only that, but depending on there's conventions as to what flight level you travel at, depending on which direction you're heading.
Yeah.
Right. So you're not flying at 18,000 feet going west while someone else is flying at 18,000 feet going east. You don't do that.
So you're saying that without violence, we wouldn't have planes just smashing into each other like the beginning of La Bamba all over the place. This is the claim.
Right. I'm dubious.
So I use that Ron Paul clip because I found it incredibly insincere on Mars' part that this is supposed to be a serious interview where he's having him on as a presidential candidate. I'm no 100% supporter of Ron Paul. I think I've been very clear about that on the show. I don't vote. I can't believe it took us an hour to say this, but this is in no way an endorsement for anything Republican.
Right.
The fact that we're choosing to use this show right before the election to criticize Marr and his support of Obama, that does not mean that if you're brand new, if you're just discovering us on Ustream, that does not mean we are in any way in favor of the alternative.
The whole tail end of that clip, I mean, the whole thing, he seemed disingenuous throughout. Like, he was not interested in having an actual conversation with Ron Paul about anything.
No.
He just wanted to get his digs in. But the very end of it was even worse, is it just seemed so petty. Like, as soon as Ron Paul got, like, a favorable reaction from Bill Maher's audience, Bill Maher had to take him down a peg.
Yeah, to re-poison. The well is becoming less poisonous, so let's make sure we re-poison it.
We've diluted the poisonous well with facts, and now I must re-poison.
Yeah. So if that was your introduction to Bill Maher, I'm sorry. Someone in the chat said, wouldn't people just be better off not knowing who Bill Maher is? Well, I mean, I've encountered people who, like, watching Bill Maher and then talking to liberals and then hearing liberals say things from the Bill Maher show. In our current age, and with all of the faults of the mainstream media, these shows that masquerade as comedy have become legitimate news sources for a lot of people. This is not even a relatively new trend, and this goes back with The Daily Show, The Colbert Report. For years, I told kids, and got in trouble for this in a private school that I worked at in 2005, that they could learn more about how the world really works by watching South Park than the mainstream media. And I stand by that statement today. So I want to get into these two fallacies that we said we would cover in the show today. The first one is composition. The second one is division. If you're just joining us, very simply put, composition is taking the properties of an individual within a group and then claiming that the entire group possesses those properties.
Mm-hmm.
Division is to take some general rules for the group, applying it down, saying the individual must have these properties.
Right.
So if a picket in a fence is white, to say that the whole fence is white is the error of composition.
Right.
Division is just the opposite. And these are both related to the fallacy of hasty generalization, which is, you know, not having enough evidence to make a proper conclusion, having too few examples to make a generalization. So fallacy of composition is an inductive error.
Mm-hmm.
Induction, or the inductive method, similar to the scientific method, basically, right, where you gather pieces of evidence and work towards a general conclusion about all of that evidence, while the deductive method is the opposite, where you start with a general rule and try to put things in to add new pieces of evidence underneath the rule. So you're supporting the rule that already exists with new examples. To read from Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology by Ayn Rand, the process of forming and applying concepts contains the essential pattern of two fundamental methods of cognition, induction and deduction. The process of observing the facts of reality and of integrating them into concepts is, in essence, a process of induction. The process of subsuming, putting under, new instances under a known concept is, in essence, a process of deduction. Mm. And remember, the philosophy of objectivism in general was to take these two this split philosophically between the rationalists and the empiricists, those who said you cannot trust like evidentiary experience and you really have to rely on your mind, people like Plato, those were the rationalists, while the empiricists were people who said you can only trust experience, your mind makes all of these errors, so you can only rely on the senses.
Right.
Rand, when objectivism came along, said, no, you need them both. You know, they work together. Kant, in the philosophy we still live in today of German idealism, which was the philosophy of the Nazis and a lot of irrationality throughout the 19th and 20th century, and like I said, continuing, right, it is the prevailing philosophy in the United States today. that reality is unknowable, your mind is untrustworthy. Right? So people say, well, geez, I can't make sense with my own mind. And this is really why the authority-based arguments that we talked about a few episodes back are so effective. So we were getting into the fallacy of composition. And of course, Marr, like we said earlier, is preaching to a choir, very liberal audience. I remember one time Hitchens, Christopher Hitchens, called him out, right? Where they said, your audience will applaud at anything, you know, that you say.
I remember that episode.
And then he flipped them off.
He did. They didn't applaud that.
No, they booed.
They booed him.
But Marr often uses the momentum of established dislike, right, to make generalizations about anyone who is against his agenda.
Right.
Right. So he can use the momentum of, oh, we don't like Romney, or we don't like Newt Gingrich, or Sheldon Adelson, as you're going to hear in a clip coming up, who was Newt Gingrich's biggest campaign contributor. So what we're going to start with is just a couple of clips that are pretty much examples, more slightly more complex than the simple examples that we looked at, not related to politics early in the show, of the fallacy of composition. So here's the Mitt Romney Company's example.
Oh, right? Yes.
This is very, very clever. So using the momentum of being anti-Romney to make a point about his political ideology in general.
So these companies, these kind of Mitt Romney companies, these businessmen who...
These companies, these kind of Mitt Romney companies.
What does that mean?
Right, so this is going to be a speech against capitalism, essentially, which I don't know why liberals think Obama is like a Che Guevara or something. I mean, somebody who was on the show is like, he's basically a Rockefeller Republican, you know, and he's a Wall Street errand boy. He's not this socialist utopian leader that all of the liberals dreamed about. But they still want to push this agenda. So these Mitt Romney kind of companies.
Well, selling Obama as a Che Guevara type mostly works on people who don't know anything about Che Guevara.
Or people who know a lot about U.S. foreign policy. What else? Because Che Guevara was a murderer. All right, let's pick that up from the beginning. Sorry, I hope that's not too controversial.
So these companies, these kind of Mitt Romney companies, these businessmen who got so up in arms when Obama said, you didn't build that. Referring to the infrastructure that made their lives possible as a company, living in a country like America where you can make a fortune.
Right.
And the Republican convention was a lot about, we did build that.
Right.
But really, what Mitt Romney did with companies is he unbuilt them.
Well, right.
He unbuilt that.
Exactly.
All right. So he's talking to Matt Taibbi, an investigative reporter who wrote a book about Romney's business past, which I'm sure these things are true. Right.
Yeah, of course.
But to make this point about people who work for profit in general, or people who think that they actually built things. So this is similar to what Elizabeth Warren said. Now, the problem with that statement, I mean, this was the thing that became a huge internet meme.
There are plenty of other problems with that, but not what people were making of it.
Sure.
Well, most people didn't hear it when he said it. Most people saw it. Heard it when somebody posted about it on Facebook.
Or after it had been reduced to that soundbite.
Right.
He should know by this point, like someone should be telling him, especially when he's reading off, you know, I mean, his speeches are usually prepared, I would think.
Right.
When he's speaking to a bunch of people, maybe that was spontaneous. But the way it is, if you have a business, you didn't build that. He allowed that sound, that sound clip to be created by saying one thing after another, you know? I've deleted things out of podcasts before that a few thousand people are listening to because I could say if somebody wanted to, they could cut that up and make me look like this or that.
Right.
You'd think he would be more careful about that. These Mitt Romney companies is a perfect example of low-hanging fruit. Here's another one. Using the momentum of the audience's hatred for this Sheldon Adelson, this big right-wing campaign funder.
And he's just one in a long line of millionaires and billionaires who have decided to spend their golden years bitching and moaning about how they're being overtaxed and underappreciated. Why has Sheldon Adelson, who I'm sure you all remember as the puppet in the Saw movies...
I said we'd excuse ad hominems.
Right.
Why has he spent $70 million to defeat Obama when his net worth during the Obama years has increased more than any other single American? I think it's because down deep, he knows he didn't earn it. No one can earn $25 billion.
So there's also a tremendous amount of like speculation here as well.
And hypocrisy.
Right.
So it's all about the rage and self-hatred that comes from feeling your life is a fraud. Rich guys have always suffered from this.
Have they?
Everybody in the audience hates this one guy, so he makes a rule for all rich guys.
Rich guys have always suffered from this. It's just that they used to deal with it by putting on a diaper and having hiring a prostitute to beat them. Now they form a super PAC. All right, that's our show.
It's funny when people talk about rich guys, they always have to find someone who's richer than they are in order to deride them.
Yep.
So like he has to go to this guy who made, you know, $23 billion because he can't talk about someone who made $23 million because then he'd be talking about himself.
Yeah, it's interesting that he did accidentally kind of apply that to himself if you're just using the general term rich guys.
Right.
I mean, $23 million net worth is very, very wealthy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so funny, the clip we played at the beginning of the show where he says, this is a selfish thing that I'm doing, voting for Obama, who will supposedly raise my taxes.
That doesn't even make any sense.
I don't know if people have heard this before. Maybe you're new to the show. Somebody in the chat mentions Michael Moore. Yes, another very similar character.
Hmm.
But why is Hollywood so liberal? And my theory, my working theory was Hollywood is so liberal because so much is taken from these people that they have to tell themselves a story. The government as my own fantasy baseball team, that it can be used for something good. And I, you know, if I continue to vote for these people, this institution that I have to dump all of these millions of dollars into or hundreds of thousands of dollars into every year, I'm sure Bill Maher pays hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes every year, if not over a million, well, it has to be good. I couldn't do that to an evil institution.
I always kind of thought it was maybe partially because the people in Hollywood are not old money. You know, people who become successful in Hollywood. I mean, there are exceptions to this, but a lot of them come from humble beginnings and maybe feel guilty about being rich.
You think so?
Because they remember what it's like to be poor. Unlike, you know, somebody who was born into a rich family. And
well, another idea might be that unlike any other profession, like that's really one where you kind of get into it by accident of your genetics and your particular talents that you were born with, as opposed to, you know, actually working hard.
And I think that
not that no one in Hollywood has worked hard to get where they are, but like a lot of them seem to just kind of stumble into it by accident.
I think it sort of feeds on itself too. Like, I think Hollywood continues to be so liberal because Hollywood is so liberal. And you're going to make the wrong kind of waves in Hollywood if you're not with the liberal program.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, whenever somebody who's like any kind of like entertainment type celebrity like leans towards more of a right-wing cause, you know, they become a laughingstock.
Yeah.
They're like kind of shunned by the rest of Hollywood.
Sure. So those are two examples of straight composition.
So Mitt Romney is like this. Mitt Romney owns a company. Therefore, everyone who owns a company is Mitt Romney.
Yeah. The opposite of composition, as we've said several times, is division. Now, in one of his overtimes, he's talking to Dinesh D'Souza, who is the creator of the Obama 2016 Obama's America movie.
Right, right.
Where it kind of like traces Obama's history all the way back to, you know, his ideological roots that are very, very, very far on the left.
Right.
Even though that hasn't really shown up. That much in anywhere except Obama's rhetoric,
right?
I don't think, and maybe a little bit here and there. What D'Souza is trying to point out now, D'Souza came out and was the pre-panel interview.
I remember
because Maher wanted 10 minutes to
really laid into him,
to really lay into him on, like, you know, how dare you investigate, you know, Obama's ideological
roots.
Really
wanted to lay into him on was that D'Souza was the one back in the politically incorrect days who supposedly actually said the thing that caused politically incorrect to get pulled off the air.
Ah, yes, and
that's
true.
What he really laid into him about.
All right, so when
it was very unprofessional.
D'Souza comes back at the end of the show. D'Souza brings up the plight of joblessness,
mm-hmm.
or people who are without jobs, and he focuses on one specific group, African Americans. So he says that here's the situation for Black Americans. You know, these are people that vote. I think Obama got 95% of the Black vote in the last election.
Mm-hmm.
So why are they not recognizing that, you know, whatever he has done in 4 years hasn't been good for them? Division is where you take the situation for the whole and then you try to apply it to the individual parts.
You got to kind of
well, but not only that, but I think this is at a time when blacks have been decimated by wealth erosion. Mm-hmm. Black unemployment is twice white unemployment. So if you were to say to the black community, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? The overwhelming answer would be no. And yet the loyalty to Obama persists.
Wait, right. We ran out of time, but I just got to address this because I heard Mitt Romney say it in the speech last night. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? What balls? 4 years ago, I was stuffing my money in my mattress. We were losing 750,000 jobs a month. What is the amnesia level in this country?
So why doesn't Obama...
Of course we're better off. No, but
can I... All right. Of course we're better off. Right. So completely steers around the specific issue that Dinesh D'Souza brought up. Now, certainly, listen, I'm not a defender of Dinesh D'Souza on every issue.
Right. His whole premise in making that proposal anyway is just kind of ridiculous. Like, if you voted for Obama 4 years ago and you're not better off now than you were then, that doesn't make Romney a good choice either. Mm. So I think it's kind of a faulty premise for him to be arguing in the first place. But that may be beside the point. So let's get back to the point.
All right. So. We see that D'Souza has a point to make.
Yes.
Right? Everything that Marr, or I don't want to say everything, but so much of what Marr does is these red herrings that, you know, take the form of other fallacies, but a red herring is anything that's going to shift away from the point that Marr doesn't like, that doesn't serve his agenda, that clashes with his talking points, and he's going to steer it somewhere else. And sometimes inserting a point of laughter.
Right.
That's the danger of these comedy type shows where Marr is a comedian, but doing serious social and political commentary, right? Inserting a point of laughter allows the discussion to totally shift in a new direction. Marr has done that. He's done the fallacy of division, saying, oh, well, we're all better off. So black people are better off. But do we even come back to that issue?
On the brink of a depression. Banks were closing everywhere. I was in my pants, as we all were. Are you kidding?
Bill, in Hollywood world, that may be true, but Obama won't be using that as a campaign slogan.
We weren't losing 750,000 jobs a month. That's just in my head.
This was the Obama.
I read it in the paper. Right. Where they put the facts.
That's because Obama's job creation wasn't real jobs created, but the jobs we prevented from being lost. It was sort of the hypothetical.
Well, that's certainly part of it.
Well, that's all made up. Those are all made up. We could have prevented 1 million jobs that would have been lost had I not done what I did. How do you prove that?
No, but these jobs were actually being lost.
Were they lost or weren't they?
You can actually measure this. There are things called facts. They're not in the Bible, but you can actually read them. The Labor Department gives out the facts.
Okay. Yeah. So it's funny that Obama ran for president criticizing the way that the Labor Department was cooking the books on unemployment, right? And they're not even counting. Unemployment numbers are only people who are in some...
Actually collecting unemployment.
In some kind of process with unemployment.
Right.
Right. Not a lot of people who've given up on and employment has run out for them.
Right.
So Obama continued those book cooking practices that the Bush administration used that he criticized them for, but Marr doesn't address that. But you see, most importantly for what we're trying to cover here, the discussion totally shifted away from the situation for black Americans.
Right. And he even threw in a dig at the Bible, which had nothing to do with what anything anybody was talking about.
Yeah,
but he knew it was going to get a response from his audience.
Pretty much ad hominem, right? Going after the kind of the right wing position that you're all irrational, racist, you know, bigots who don't believe in global warming and are selfish and greedy. I mean, that's the idea that he's pushing on the show again and again.
Okay, now I just want to step out of the live show. This is days later. Now I'm at home. It's still election day. Oh, when will this day be over, right? So I can go back to watching television advertising in peace. But there was quite a few things that we didn't get to because of the time constraints of the live show. I learned something from watching all these clips of Bill Maher in preparation for the show. Sometimes composition and division fallacies can be combined together in one statement. And here things can get a little sloppier. And that also has some implications for the rhetoric in general on Real Time with Bill Maher. So I'm going to play you a clip. This actually deals with 9/11 truth, okay? Not one of my major issues. But this is interesting. He's talking to Cornel West and the singer John Legend in this clip.
A missile was what brought down Flight 93, and that the World Trade Center was a planned explosion. Do you believe any of those conspiracy theories? Do you think it's even possible?
No, I don't believe it, but I know the world is a mysterious place.
I think.
Which means I'm open to coordinated activity. in secret places, but I don't believe in conspiracy.
Wow. I think the government...
You could be a Republican.
I think the government is dishonest and they try to keep secrets from us, but they're not that good at keeping secrets, apparently, because they keep coming out. People keep leaking them. So I don't believe that they could coordinate that well and pull it off without us finding out.
Yeah, it seems like if they couldn't get a helicopter into the Superdome, they probably couldn't get some of this stuff going.
All these conspiracy theories have the two basic problems. One, they believe the government is competent. And two, they believe the government can keep a secret.
The last person you heard from in that clip was Richard Clark, who was a big counterterrorism guy during the Bush administration, kind of fell out of favor with Republicans, especially talking heads in the right-wing media, when he dared to tell the truth about government failures around 9/11, or his truth, or his understanding of what happened anyway. That personal accountability, that was not popular during the presidency of George W. Bush. But it did, propel his career forward for opportunities to write books and to, you know, get appearances on The Bill Maher Show. And, you know, I don't think he's an unlikable or dishonest guy. But if you accept the premise there, conspiracies are impossible. Because as Bill Maher points out, they couldn't get a helicopter into the Superdome. So how could a small group of people carry out some kind of clandestine operation? Now, this has nothing to do with 9/11 truth. I mean, there's plenty of examples of this in, I could just start naming Operation This, Operation That, MK Ultra, da-da-da. We don't have to go off on that tangent. There's plenty of examples of government conspiracies being very, very real. And I think for a lot of people who come to be liberty-minded, there's a point where they ask themselves a question: is the government really good at doing bad things, or is the government really bad at doing good things? And the answer is both. There is a government apparatus that is set up to serve people. That is shit. But there's also another part of government that is very much set up to serve the interests of the powerful. And it's not one thing that can all exist under this umbrella term government. So yes, did the government fail to help people in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina? Yes, they did. Very inefficient in that respect. So to take the composition of FEMA and then apply it to government, because FEMA is part of the government, that also gets the CIA or the NSA off the hook for any in the shadows type operations that they might be involved in. So we go FEMA to government is composition. And then with the rule for government, applying it down to some of the more secretive groups, the groups that operate without any oversight, they couldn't do anything either because they are part of government. Composition to division. But this composition plus division has occurred other times as well. And in the other examples that I have, they work to serve Maher's political agenda, or, you know, Maher's writer's political agenda, much better than that 9/11 discussion, which was just kind of an isolated thing. So as the presidential election heated up, the target on Real Time with Bill Maher was clearly Mitt Romney, right? So at one point a couple months ago, and this lasted for several weeks, several episodes of the show, one of the hot topics was the women vote. Now at the time, Romney hadn't really said anything particularly damning against women. He did later go on to say something like he had names of women in binders for jobs in Massachusetts or something, and they made some hay with that. But before they had that example, they had to, you know, reach a little more to find ways to connect Romney with some kind of anti-woman agenda. I mean, it's just like if they were just honest, they could say, well, he's a politician and politicians are generally anti-people and women are people. I bet there's a lot of composition and division in there as well. Okay, here's another example, right? Now, remember, the target is Romney and the issue is the woman vote.
How these guys are almost tied among women, I don't know. Especially since today, as if the Republicans didn't need any more of this. Joe Walsh, not the Eagles guy, the...
douchebag congressman from Illinois said, listen to this, he said, abortions to save the life of the mother, that's just an excuse. That's what he said. He said, modern technology and science make it so you cannot find one instance where there is dying in childbirth. Okay, ladies, before Election Day comes, ask your doctor if the Tea Party is right for you.
Now, did you notice the setup?
How these guys are almost tied among women, I don't know.
So that is in reference to Romney and Obama. And that is the last time that they are mentioned in that soundbite. He then, to speak against Romney, brings up Republicans, right? But then goes to an isolated example of a Republican. Now, let's kind of, like, for Marr, the Tea Party and Republican kind of interchangeable. So he gives the example of this guy, Joe Walsh, who says this ridiculous thing and then brings that up to the Tea Party, which is basically an umbrella term for people who do not agree with his position. And in the end, subtly, that is applied back down to Romney, even though it had absolutely nothing to do with Romney. But he makes the point, as far as his audience is concerned, he makes the point that he set out to make that these two guys should not be anywhere near tied when it comes to the woman vote. Women vote, woman vote. Oh, man, I hate even talking about this stuff. I can't wait till this show is over. Whew. So they squeeze as much as they can out of this whole crazy things that Republicans say, Mitt Romney is a Republican motif. And there is a myriad of examples of Republicans, people who call themselves Republicans or Tea Partiers, saying really crazy things. So here's another example. I believe this was from the very next week.
But answer me this one question. I mean, the polls show that now this is probably not recent since the second debate, but certainly after the first debate, Mitt Romney almost closed the gender gap with women. How come a party who is just to the right of Andrew Dice Clay
Dice?
On women issues.
Okay, now what you just heard was the setup, and no points for originality here because it's exactly the same tactic from the clip you just heard. On the panel with him, he has two Republicans and some ridiculous woman from MSNBC. Her name is like Dolly or Goldie or something like that. I had never heard of her before, but she was very rambunctious. And the stage is set now to do exactly the same fallacy. So he's going to go to this example of the guy who said if it's a legitimate rape, like a woman can't get pregnant if she was raped legitimately because the body has some kind of magical power to reject that. I mean, I know, like, it's not like the Republicans, some Republicans don't make this really easy for Marr to get away with this stuff with some of the things they say. But the two Republicans on the panel will immediately jump in to try and correct this. No, that's not, you cannot do that composition fallacy right there, even though they might not know that term. But watch how beaten down they get when they try to point out this reasoning error.
With women, how come a party who is just to the right of Andrew Dice Clay
Dice?
On women issues, that believes legitimate rape, member Senator Aiken.
That this guy Joe. Our party.
Aiken does not represent your party when Ryan co-sponsors, you know, personhood legislation with him around the country. Come on, Aiken doesn't represent your party.
Can be a simple explanation.
Now, I said when we first stepped away from the live show that there are some real rhetorical benefits for Marr for this political agenda by repeatedly using this fallacy over and over again, which I'm not going to defend Republicans here, but what Marr is able to do is paint anyone, because this has happened with libertarians like Penn Jillette, Ron Paul, Nick Gillespie, or as libertarian as they might be. Anybody who is outside of Marr's political viewpoint, which he considers to be entirely rational and the only option you have in America for not being stupid. And basically the tone is, well, you know, if you disagree with me, it's either because you're a bigot or a misogynist or a rapist or some kind of religious mystic. So this whole the bigotry of anyone who disagrees with me foundation is constantly employed on the show to steer around criticisms of Obama or his political viewpoint. Here's an example. This is Christine O'Donnell, the witch woman, who should be pretty easy to deal with as a political debate opponent. They're talking about the economy.
When they say, oh, okay, look, the numbers are increasing, how many are we losing? You can't only look at the statistics you want to. You have to look at the overall picture. And as much as whether it's a popular president like Clinton or Obama himself trying to make people believe that the economy is better.
He's a witch.
You know, they want to try to cast a spell over people so that they don't see what's really happening.
Well,
and the reality is you have people who are taking jobs that are half of what they used to. You've got a 50% unemployment rate or half the college graduates who can't find jobs because they're competing with executives.
Now, it sounds like she might be on a bit of a roll here, right? Now, I don't know if the statistics that she's bringing up are entirely accurate or not, but it doesn't matter because Marr doesn't seem to have a response to these claims that she's making. So what does he do? Red herring, building on the bigotry of anyone who disagrees with me foundation.
But you talk like all the bad happened the day he took office. Before then, everything was going great, and then President Blackenstein took office and started walking through the ghetto with shoeboxes full of cash, and that really isn't quite what happened.
No, that's not. You're right.
So now Christine O'Donnell has lost whatever momentum she had making her case against Obama, and we're talking about something else where, as you just heard her say, Bill Maher is right.
And that's part of why there was such a backlash against Republicans, why they lost in 2006, because they started abandoning the principles that they stand for about limited government, lower spending.
Now, she tries to pull it back together, but it lasts for less than a minute.
But Obama did make things worse. And he's sitting there trying to blame the Bush years. But the reality is, the first 2 years of his administration, he had a Democrat Congress. He could have done whatever he wanted.
Another advantage of being the host of the show is you can just sarcastically and condescendingly dismiss the last thing that your opponent said and move on to a different subject.
He could have implemented all those policies that would have made everything better, but he didn't.
All right. No, he's terrible.
There's many examples of this. This is like a pretty consistent theme on the show, but here's one more. And this one speaks to my disappointment with this show more generally. If you go back and you watch this show in 2004, in 2005, during the lead up to the Iraq War, during Hurricane Katrina, you would be so disappointed to see what it has become today. And as quite possibly, as I said earlier, the smartest political debate show, where the most opportunity exists to really talk about what's actually going on, there are so many opportunities that are just completely squandered. Listen to this. And it's him steering around an opportunity to address a really important subject to just do the same bigotry of everyone who disagrees with me trick again. This conversation deals with Obama's $6 trillion in new debt.
It's also true that when Bush was president, he didn't pay for anything, and that was okay, because he was white, he had good credit.
So can I say...
When President Blackenstein gets in office, he has no credit at all. He's got to pay everything with cash.
We talk all the time on this show about how there is no difference between the two political parties, and when people get into power, they generally do the same thing. And their backgrounds, their agendas really don't matter because their only agenda is power. Romney and Obama are similar in every way that really matters. But nobody, you know, in the mainstream, aside from George Carlin, dares to address that. And instead what they do, I said I would excuse ad hominem attacks from this episode because Real Time with Bill Maher is a comedy show. In this case, there is one type of ad hominem attack that is particularly disastrous, and it is called ad hominem tu corcre. Tu corcre in Latin translates to you also or you're another. So instead of having this realization, wow, my guy and your guy do pretty much the same type of shit when they get into power, no. Let's take Maher, for example, in this case. The liberal, when Obama's accused, goes on the defensive and says, well, Bush does it too. Well, isn't there a realization we could have there? But instead, no, it's just this two wrongs make a right turd toss instead of a very important realization that could help everybody involved in the conversation grow up politically. We're going to conclude the show today with what I believe, from everything I've seen and heard of the Real Time with Bill Maher show, to be the two best efforts of guests to break the matrix during the discussion. The first one is going to be Penn Jillette, and the second one is Nick Gillespie from Reason TV. We'll jump back to the live show for that one. But here, Penn Jillette is asked about libertarianism, and he makes a really strong, commendable effort for about 1 minute to point out the gun in the room.
I think libertarians, it's become radicalized.
Well, yeah.
This new Rand Paul type of libertarian.
My feeling of libertarianism is if you want to get to utopia, you take your first left on sex and your first right on money. I just think the more freedom we can get, the better. I don't see why... I want to answer every question, start every question. This is not the finish, but start every question with, is there any way we can solve this problem with more freedom instead of less? Morality does matter. I mean, it's never talked about. It's always pragmatic in politics. But my question is, the government should only use violence for things I'm willing to use violence for. I would use violence, except for being a coward. But put that aside. Theoretically, I would use violence to stop a murder, to stop a rape. I would not use violence to build a library. So I will argue with you that we should build a library. I will raise money for a library. I will work for a library, but I will not say that we need to bring tax people with guns to say, okay, Bill, we need a library.
Now, for Bill Maher, there's only one thing that could possibly follow a truth like that. A red herring. He's got a bucket of them.
For defense, I'll do
that. We have the internet. We don't need a library at all. It's a terrible example.
It's a bad example.
I didn't know anyone who's gone to a library since 1990.
And you know, I'm always disappointed with the people on the panel, really intelligent people sometimes, who just let him get away with this. That being said, I was really, really excited when I saw Nick Gillespie on the show. So let's jump back to the live show from Thursday and we'll finish up.
So the clip we didn't get to was Nick Gillespie. So Nick Gillespie is the editor of Reason TV, Reason Magazine.
Right.
He's on the show with Rachel Maddow. I'm not sure who else is there, but it's Maher, Maddow, and somebody else versus Nick Gillespie. And
okay.
He's great on the show. He's been on at least a couple times that I've heard. What they're talking about is the drug war.
Oh, yeah.
And this is where he tries to address some of the problems with the conversation and the box that the conversation is occurring in.
What can you say when Uruguay is leading the way into the future of freedom by legalizing marijuana?
I feel so contrarian. I feel all of a sudden I feel like a narc. Like, I'm against the drug war, too, but I just wanted to...
Well, you should not be forced by your Democratic partisanship to be forced into... Wait.
I'm just trying to say a nice thing, and already you're a hack.
No, no, that's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying, but you will always take the side...
Let us reason together.
You will always take the side of a Democrat over a Republican.
No, I won't.
This is Maddow. If you're unfamiliar, the woman talking is like a Chris Matthews-style show on MSNBC.
I remember this episode now, and I remember what a pain in the ass she was.
What's an example?
You don't even know me.
What's an example? I've seen your show.
I assume that you've always done this thing.
We spent almost 5 minutes back watching Kirk Douglas. But what's a Republican? What's a Republican that you pick over a Democrat? An issue of party.
That's not a fair question. If there were you could ask me the same question. Yeah. I could answer that question.
But I asked her
20 years ago. But Republicans have changed. Okay. I haven't changed. You probably would say the same thing. It's they who have changed, not us. 20 years ago.
What?
That can't possibly be true.
Hold that thought.
Okay.
So there were Republicans, absolutely, who were reasonable. They are a extinct species
so,
now.
But the important thing is that you're not a partisan. This is my point. I'm just
yes,
saying,
both things can be true.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
If there are no people
on that...
You're
not a partisan, but you will always be against the Republicans.
Only if they continue to act like the party of the mental patient.
Well, what are you mad
yes,
about?
That's exactly right.
That you're mad about that.
I'm not mad about it. All I'm saying is that I refuse to be put into a false choice of like you're either with the Democrats or the Republicans, and that's the way this.
Well, get
this,
out of your box. You're putting yourself
conversation.
In. You're
no,
the only one in this part of the
conversation. This conversation has been framed as aren't the Republicans just doing this as a show trial, et cetera? And it's
yes.
like,
well,
no,
if that's
Eric Holder is bad.
They're talking about Fast and Furious. So I like his conclusion here.
Well, if that's Eric Holder is bad, the Republicans are bad. The drug war is bad. There's a lot of badness in the world.
Well, the drug war is bad, and the Republicans are mental patients. I don't know if Eric Holder is bad.
Okay.
In that conversation, Gillespie basically summarizes the whole show.
Yeah.
All 260 episodes of Real Time with Bill Maher, or all episodes since Obama became president, right? Now they say, you're the only one who's in a box. He's the only one who's not in the box.
Right.
You know? Which I think is interesting. Now,
you're a tell.
I'm not partisan towards the Democrats, but the Republicans are all mental patients.
That's the either or. That's the false dichotomy.
Right, right.
Now, what did you say? You said, I have a hard time believing that's true.
When he says, it's the Republicans have changed. I haven't changed.
This part right here.
Okay. I haven't changed. You probably would say the same thing. It's they who have changed.
Okay. So what Bill Maher is saying is that nothing that has happened in the world in the past 20 years has made him change any of his views.
How would you describe Bill Maher politically?
I don't know if I could honestly describe Bill Maher politically. I know how he presents himself on his show.
Does he support carbon tax?
Yes, he does.
Does he support graduated progressive income tax?
Yes.
Does he support universal health care?
Yes, he does.
All right. So he has some ideas that are very
liberal,
socialist. He said on his show that European socialism works. We should be more like Europe. These are things that Bill Maher has said. Now,
and yet he describes himself as a sort of a kind of a libertarian.
Well, I mean, there are left libertarians, but they're obviously not for like European socialism, like Scandinavia, I wouldn't think. Bill Maher, I don't think he understood what that term meant.
No.
But Bill Maher has not been. One of the reasons why I wanted to focus on this a little bit is if somebody changes their position, like I don't understand why the Republicans went after John Kerry in 2004, or even to some degree why Democrats go after Romney today. Like as time goes on, you know, people can learn new things and change their positions on certain issues. I wouldn't want people judging me today based on things I would have done or said 6 or 7 years ago.
Right.
Now, obviously, we can learn a lot. I think a lot of you.
Romney's a pretty poor example of that. I've seen Romney change his mind about things in a
sentence. Yeah. Okay. Romney is a bad example of that. But I think like if there were a bunch of tapes leaked of me teaching history 6 years ago.
Yeah.
That would not be good for School Sucks podcast unless people could understand that in that time I've learned a lot.
If somebody has literally never changed any of their thoughts or opinions in the past 20 years, something is wrong with that person.
Yes.
It's fine to change.
Yeah.
But the only reason that I want to call Bill Maher out is because he claims that he hasn't changed.
Right.
All right. So this is a clip from Politically Incorrect at the end of the 2000 presidential campaign, where he and a young up-and-coming television star named Joe Rogan double team a guest on the panel named David McReynolds. Guess what he does?
Now, we had the conventions the week before and the week before that. Now it's the week we're trying to do a little justice to the other candidates. Mr. McReynolds, you are the Socialist Party candidate.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Now, one of the things that bothered me about the other two conventions is I thought that they were all lying. And one of the lies, the Democrats...
That's what politicians do, isn't it?
Well, I don't think Mr. McReynolds does it. I think he's sincere about his platform. I just think his platform is whack.
Oh,
now,
no.
Now, let me... I'll bet
you agree with a chunk of it. Like, for example, legalizing marijuana and putting heroin in the hands of doctors instead of addicts. I suspect you agree with that.
I'll vote for that.
Okay. Let's go to
there's some agreement.
There is some agreement.
All right.
But the rest of your platform would wreck America.
We don't agree on it.
Okay. Let me, just because, listen, you say you want a 30-hour work week.
Yep.
Okay, $12 minimum wage.
Yep.
6 weeks paid vacation, free college, free mass transit, free legal services, free health care, free daycare.
Unicorns, rainbows, and little green men.
Actually, we already have half of those things. You've got free legal aid now.
Bad legal
aid. You had, yeah, I know, we'd like to have much better legal aid, but you have.
But it's not
and
really
when I went
free,
to college,
somebody
it was.
Pays in the
oh,
end.
Bill, you're right on that, and I wish
somebody's going to have to.
This has to come out of tax funds. If you want this, you have to pay for it.
So how much?
80% of your taxes, right?
But you're going to cut back on the taxes because people are going to be working 30-hour weeks, so there's not as much income.
Yeah, but the lazy people still get to be lazy.
We are going to lift the taxes on those who are very wealthy. There's no question that the socialist, if it was elected, if you earned $1 million,
more than 48%.
Oh yes, much more than that.
You want more than 48% taxes?
This is Rogan.
Depends on what your income is.
What
would be the highest? What tax rate do we need?
That's crazy. You want more than half?
For the folks who are working poor, who earn very little, they should pay no tax whatever.
They don't pay tax now.
Yeah, but those folks who are taking home a pile of money, yes, they should pay a high tax.
But how
they
do?
Like Bill Gates, no, they should pay a higher.
They already pay.
Let me tell you something, that's wrong.
Anyone who makes over $250,000 in America already pays half.
We're in favor of lifting that higher.
I know you.
Everybody
who's in a socialist government situation all wants to come here to make money. Where the hell are we going to go?
I don't think that's quite that.
Yeah.
One of the things which is really obscene is that in this country, the average CEO earns 400 times what the average guy does who works a 40-hour week. Something is wrong with that.
Yeah, but you know, the average CEO never works a 40-hour week. First of all, they never worked a 40-hour week to get there. They had to bust their ass to go through school. It's not easy to become a CEO.
I mean, in general, I've always thought socialism is like marriage. It's good in theory. It just doesn't work practically.
It's utopia.
Oh, well, you know what? I feel better. After that clip, we took a phone call from a listener named John out in Hawaii. You heard that in the previous installment of School Sucks podcast. So that was pretty much the end of our discussion. You know what? I feel like I'm ready to move on beyond Bill Maher. You know? Like sometimes I think people can get so angry, so frustrated with what's going on out there. It's nice to have a podcast or a blog or a friend to talk to, whatever. Because it's just this little release valve that you can turn and, you know, let it out. Some of you might have found this to be a very frustrating show. I'm sorry, but I hope I was diplomatic enough. Maybe you could suggest it to a liberal friend if you're still, you know, hanging out with liberal friends. Everyone's got one, right? From college. Steve, remember Steve? Who was great in so many other ways. And, you know, that last clip, maybe there's hope for Bill Maher. I don't know what happened. It's so weird, you know? Nobody, like, learns their way into socialism. So I was, you know, thinking all these things, like he caved into the pressure, like this is what the mainstream media demands. He's got to stay competitive with other pseudo-debate shows on television that deal with political topics. But then when he gave $1 million to Obama, man, I was stunned. And I had stopped watching the show because I found it to be frustrating. And you know what? Frankly, don't do things that frustrate you. That's my advice. But in preparation for this episode, I did have to watch and listen to quite a bit of the real-time show. And, you know, I feel overcome with relief that I don't have to do that anymore. Still election day, by the way. Now, 8:15 p.m. And if you happen to be that liberal who downloaded and listened to this podcast at the suggestion of a friend, and Romney won this thing, I just want to say congratulations on being anti-war again and anti-police state. It's nice to have you back. And if you choose to get active for either one of those causes, anti-war or anti-police state, I'm thinking that the next 4 years are going to be filled with opportunities to keep you busy. All right, since it is election day, I'm going to leave you with my favorite clip of the late comedian George Carlin. Thanks for listening, and take care.
So I have solved this little political dilemma for myself in a very simple way. On election day, I stay home. I don't vote. Two reasons I don't vote. First of all, it's meaningless. This country was bought and sold and paid for a long time ago. The shit they shuffle around every 4 years doesn't mean a fucking thing. And secondly, I don't vote because I believe if you vote, you have no right to complain. People like to twist that around, I know. They say, well, if you don't vote, you have no right to complain. But where's the logic in that? If you vote and you elect dishonest, incompetent people and they get into office and screw everything up, well, you are responsible for what they have done. You caused the problem. You voted them in. You have no right to complain. I, on the other hand, who did not vote, who, in fact, did not even leave the House on Election Day, am in no way responsible for what these people have done and have every right to complain as loud as I want about the mess you created that I had nothing to do with. So I know that a little later on this year, you're going to have another one of those really swell presidential elections that you like so much. You'll enjoy yourselves. It'll be a lot of fun. I'm sure as soon as the election is over, your country will improve immediately. As for me, I'll be home on that day doing essentially the same thing as you. The only difference is when I get finished masturbating, I'm going to have a little something to show for it, folks. Thank you very much.